My people, what is going on? It's the Wealthy Guy here, and welcome to the My People Podcast, where we talk with influencers in business, fashion, and lifestyle. I am your host, the Wealthy Guy. I'm a men's style expert, custom clothier, and published photographer. On the last episode of the first season of the My People Podcast, I am here with Javon Rogers, and he's going to be interviewing me today. So, you know, we talk all the time, and he's like, people really don't even know that much about you. They just know that you're the wealthy guy. Do people even know your name? And I was like, you're right. People don't even know my name. So today, Javon is actually going to be asking me questions so that the listeners can get to know me as a person a little better. So Javon, thanks for being on the podcast.
Absolutely.
All right. So I'm actually down here in Atlanta with Javon. I came down because I have some things going on, and he's having a big end of summer party. So I had to be here because I'm always working. And, you know, we said that we were going to do this while I was here. And so now we're here, and I'm going to hand it over to him. So he's really going to lead this podcast, and you know, I'm going to kind of be the guest on it. Hopefully he won't ask me anything too crazy, but he got his list of questions ready. And he's known me for a very, very long time. So he knows like a lot about me. So he knows like what to ask. So we're going to get right into it. Javon.
Perfect. Yes, people. We are here with the wealthy guy today on his final episode of his podcast. So it seems like just yesterday we were talking about you actually doing a podcast.
Right.
And I was like, well, how are you going to do a podcast? You're doing photography, you know, you're making suits, coats, doing all these different things. So first, you know, one of the things that we talked about a couple of weeks ago is I said, do people even know what your name is? They just call you the wealthy guy. I know we've been out and people are like, you're that guy from Instagram. You're the wealthy guy.
Right.
You know, and so I was like, the people don't even know your name. So your name is?
My name is Robert Pauly III.
The third is like rich.
Yeah.
It's like rich. Whenever I meet someone that has like a third in a name, I'm like, ooh, they come from a good family.
Right. So like the third or the fourth.
If you're the fourth,
then you know it's like long lineage of money, but I don't come from money.
Right. So just Robert was like, you know what? I think he can get a job. So we'll name your grandfather, your father. And yeah, let's name him too. We all need jobs. So that worked out for you. But Robert Pauly III. So tell the people, your community, a little bit about kind of how you, you know, came up in this world.
Yeah. So, you know, I'll go back. And then bring it forward. So, you know,
Robert babies and pacifiers.
Babies. Right. Where my baby nickname was Boopa. So Robert Pauly III, you know, I am originally from the Bronx, New York. My family, interesting enough, my mom's family and my dad's family actually lived across the street from each other.
Okay.
Yeah. So I, you know.
It's like the round the way girl.
Exactly. So my dad, I guess he, you know, saw my mom and was like, who's that? You know, I want to holla. And, you know, they got in a relationship and then they had me. But grew up in the Bronx, went to, you know, elementary, middle school in the Bronx. Growing up from about 10 years old up until probably about 18, I actually was in the foster care system.
Really?
Yeah. But luckily for me, I was actually with my family.
Right.
So firstly with my aunt, and then with, you know, for the most part, my aunt moved to St. Thomas. She met a man and she hit it.
Okay. Down, Stella.
Right.
Stella
went to get her groove back. And then my grandmother kind of took over from there. So a lot of those early adolescent memories are, you know, memories of like my mom not being there. And, you know, me living with my grandmother, my brother and I living with my grandmother. So I had one brother, and we could talk a little bit about that later. Yeah, and I even still remember like the social worker's name. Her name was Starlet Jenkins.
Starlet, shout out to Starlet Jenkins.
Yeah, shout out to Starlet Jenkins. And, you know, I was a kid that was, you know, a good student, always like, you know, in like the honors classes and always involved with something in school or, you know, even after school volunteering like at the community center. So right. Once I got too old to actually go there as a kid, I started to like volunteer there like after school. So that was like kind of like my way to like stay off the streets.
Right, right.
And as well as give back. And when I was a kid, I was a really good dancer. So
before we get to the break dancing, I want to step back a moment because, you know, I was also in foster care.
Right.
It wasn't for a long time. It was for about a year. And I also was with a family friend.
Right.
When I tell people my story of being in foster care, people reveal that they actually was in foster care,
right,
too, because, you know, back in the 90s and the early 2000s, it was
right.
looked at like, oh, my God, you were in foster care. You were like
right.
an abandoned child.
Right.
But that's not really the case. But what I also know about being in foster care with the people that I've connected with anyway, is that they're like super ambitious people.
Right.
So like what did you observe in your foster care transition or even as a child
right.
that kind of you were able to grab onto and say, I want to do something. I want to be this kind of person or do something like this as I become an adult.
That's a good question. So I think the thing for me when I was a kid, so let me step back a bit. So the way that we got into foster care was I observed drugs, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like with my dad, and I just observed violence. Like I just observed things that I knew weren't right. Mm-hmm. And things that were scary to me and things that, you know, I felt like even at that time, like this is not the type of life that I want to have.
Right.
And
you learn from it. You don't have to always experience it. You can just observe
right,
it.
Right. Yeah. So I just kind of and that's what kind of led to, you know, me being in foster care was, you know, one day I was like, you know, going to school, but I decided like not to go to school. And I decided to, like I said, like my mom's family and my dad's family lived across the street from each other. Mm-hmm. I decided to not go to school and sneak and go to like my grandmother's house mm-hmm. to like tell her what was going on. Yeah.
Big and, mama's house.
Yeah. And my father actually caught me. Like not going to school and like, you know, saw me outside and like roughed me up and like, it was very scary at the time. Right. And like roughed me up. But then after that, I actually did get to my grandmother's house and like told them what had been going on. And then from there, it was like they removed us and, you know, then we were staying with them. But just observing that and, you know, they're always being like, especially from my father, violence and just situations where I was just like, no, this is, you know, this is not right. And this is not the type of life that I want to live. And like my first step in getting out of that situation was going to tell my grandmother and then, you know, going to live with them.
Okay. So that happened, that transition. And, you know, from 10 over to 18, you were kind of with your grandmother, kind of
right.
in foster care. What was high school like for Robert?
Oh, man. So high school was definitely my high school years were good. I wasn't the most popular person, but I was very known, right? Like I said, I was like a good dancer.
Okay. Okay, let's get to the dance. I want to get back to that. So let's talk about what kind of dancing was going on.
It was hip hop dancing.
Okay, so you were like a Jabberwocky.
So you know, since I was a little kid, I chicken noodle was always a good dancer, and like I had a lot that like
getting like it was like early 2000s.
Me and my cousin, like money to like dance, and we just like get out there.
You're from New York, so crazy. But as I started to get older,
all types of different dances that originated
part of organized. So whatever the dances were, so that also were the dances that we did, and we did like all types of like flips.
So even before, I couldn't do no split or nothing like that. But
where I competed,
all type of flips,
competition, and
this and that, and the other.
They were called the Soundview dancers.
So, right? I did, you know, I danced.
Exactly.
And then in high school, I also was, again, you know, still kind of like an honors program, things like that.
Community center in my neighborhood.
One thing that really kind of changed things for me was being a part of the Academy of Finance.
Okay.
So Academy of Finance is a program. I still believe that the program goes on. It's a program where you... you know, they teach you about business, and you get to take, I think it's one or two college level classes.
Okay.
And I was actually the junior class and senior class like rep for like the program. So every, I want to say it was like once a month or something like that, I would, you know, put on my suit and go down to American Express. American Express, and participate in these meetings with, you know, the student leaders from all of the other like high schools in New York that were a part of like the Academy of Finance. Mm-hmm. But one of the key pieces of the Academy of Finance was that you got an internship and a financial like services company. So my internship was with Citi.
Citibank.
Yeah, it was with Citi, and that was like my introduction to
the finance world.
Exactly. And I was like, this is where I want to.
This is where you want to be.
Yeah, this is where I want to be.
This is where you fit in.
Yeah, I want to wear a suit and I want to go to work and, you know, I want to have, you know, take my briefcase and I want to have a corner office. And this is. And this is where I want to go. It took me some time to actually get there, though.
Right.
But that was the first like introduction where I said, this is the life that I want.
Life that you want. So what year would you say that was in when you were a part of, you know, the Financial Academy and you got that internship? You were, you know, the lead, the representative for your middle school.
That was like 11th, 12th grade.
So 11th and 12th grade. Yeah. Okay, so you mentioned something and I want to jump back to it because it to me, it is definitely comes full circle with who the wealthy guy is today.
Right.
And you mentioned, you know, so I would put on my suit and go to these meetings. So in 11th grade, you know, where, you know, 16, 17 years old and you're wearing a suit. How do you feel as a 16, 17 year old wearing a suit? One.
Yep.
But going to like Citibank, like one of the top banks in the world.
Listen, you couldn't tell me nothing. Like, you know, when I think back on it, the suit was kind of baggy, right?
Suit.
And it wasn't a good.
But that was the style.
Right. And it wasn't a good, you know, quality fabric that I'm accustomed
to.
I'm
glad that it wasn't because at 16, 17, if you had a quality suit, you kind of have a silver spoon in your mouth.
Right, exactly.
You know?
But, you know, I had my suit and, you know.
A book bag? What did you wear?
What was
the book bag?
I don't think I took a book bag to like the internship. I probably had some type of carry bag, you know? But the way that I felt in that suit was I felt important.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like somebody, you know, like I felt like a man. I felt like, you know, a functioning member of society.
And how did people look at you?
People looked at me like I was somebody.
Like you were somebody, right? I don't know what it is about a suit. I don't care if it's a cheap suit. I don't care if it's a hand-me-down. I don't care if it's the best suit in the world. When you put on a jacket and pants,
right,
it's like people instantly offer you respect.
They do. They
no do. Matter how old you are.
No matter how old you are. That is so true. And I felt respected, and I felt respect for myself.
Right.
Right. I felt confident. I felt, you know, like I said, for lack of better words, I felt like a man.
Right.
Yeah. And I felt like somebody that was doing things in the world. And it just, it was a good feeling. And mm-hmm. from that kind of like that point on, like, I just knew that I wanted to wear suits.
Right.
Because I wanted to always have that feeling. Yeah. Right.
That feeling. Excellent. Yeah. I knew that the first time I put on a suit, I had a similar experience. So yours is a little bit younger than mine. So it was like, well, I wonder how you felt. Did we share the same experience
right.
when we wore a suit? And I bet if we asked 100 men, like,
right.
you know, Family Feud, that all of them would probably say the same thing, that you yeah. felt important and that people respected you and offered you respect and looked at you differently.
Oh, for sure.
Because you had on a suit. Not that you were any different.
Right.
But you had on something that said, hey, I'm a person
to seriously.
Be, take me seriously. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay, so you get through that, you go to college. So what college did you go to?
Yeah, so at first I went to Niagara University, okay. but I finished my degree at Baruch.
World-renowned Baruch.
World-renowned Baruch College. And while I was at Baruch, I also worked there. Mm. So the way that I got, you know, connected with Baruch is I was working for like a not-for-profit, like doing like a temp job.
Okay.
And I actually, you know, it was like a temp job and it was like a probationary period. And me being the person that I am, like when I see things that I don't like, I have to speak up about it. And, you know, I voiced my, you know, concern and opinion on certain things there. And I remember the day like that the big boss called me in the office mm-hmm. and he was like, you know, we're not going to extend you past the probationary, you know, period. And I was hot. But it was actually a blessing, mm-hmm. right? Because I had built a community at this place amongst like my coworkers. I had people there that liked me, that actually, you know, were people, you know, in my corner. And, you know, when I got like essentially like let go from that, you know, someone there was like, hey, listen, I really want to help you out, like mm-hmm. to find another job. One of the places that they sent me on an interview to was Baruch.
Okay.
And when I think back to it, I actually didn't get the job. Right. So it was me against this other girl, like for like this HR like position. Mm-hmm. And they actually gave it to her.
Okay.
But the HR person, you know, called me up and like, you know, told me that they were going to go with someone else. But he said, I really like you. I want to see if, you know, there's something else for you here. Mm-hmm. I actually have something else that I would like for you to interview for. They're looking for someone in campus operations. You know, do you want to interview for it? And I was like, yeah, I guess so. You know, and I did. And that day, I went into the interview and I sat down with the hiring manager, my boss, his name, shout out to Frank Antonucci. And I sat down with him and within 5 minutes into the conversation, he was just like, I like you. And he was like, I want to offer you the job.
Okay, on the spot.
On the spot.
On the spot.
On the spot. On
no
the spot.
Waiting for no callback.
No waiting for no callback. And my life has somewhat been like that, where I go and, you know, interview for something and like kind of get offered the job like right away. And he offered me the job and I accepted the job. Little did I know that, you know, there was so much work because there hadn't been somebody doing a job for like 4 months.
So you had to do your job and then some, play catch up.
Right.
I want to point out something important. So you went from the internship that kind of chopped you, for lack of better words, and they were like, they weren't going to extend your stay.
Right.
And then someone said, hey, you know what? I like you. I want to see you succeed. Let me refer you over here. So you went for the HR assistant position.
Right.
And then they said, well, hey, we're not going to take you.
Right.
But we like you. So what do you think it takes for people to like you?
Oh, that's a really
because
good question.
A lot of people always say that people don't like them and they didn't get something.
Right.
But these people didn't know you.
They didn't.
But they liked you and they wanted to help you out. What do you think are the attributes for to be likable?
That is good. That is a really good question. But I'll tell you what he said to me. He said, I get good vibes from you. He said, I get good vibes from, he said, I see something in you. I feel something good about you, you know? And I think that for, that goes both ways.
Right.
Because there are people that meet me that don't like me.
Right.
Right. Like that's that say they don't like my vibes. Right. But then on the other hand, there are a lot of people who do meet me and say, I love his vibes.
Right. But more importantly, like you're a 19, 20 year old black young man.
Right.
And people are saying, I would think that they were older people.
Right.
Who had some influence.
Right.
Liked you.
Right.
But didn't know you.
Right.
So what do you think?
I think honestly, it was the way that I carried myself.
And what was that? How did you carry yourself?
I dressed up.
You had on a suit.
I had on a suit. And that suit gave me that confidence that I like needed.
I belonged in the seat.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So like that suit gave me kind of like that confidence. And not only that, you know, I think that I have a talent for presenting myself.
Okay.
And presenting myself authentically where I'm just like, okay, this is what it is. I'm going to go in, you know, I'm a kind of cold switch a little bit, right?
Right.
I'm a cold switch a little bit, but I'm still give them who, you know, who I am. And I think that just like there are people who like you, you know, don't like you, there are people who instantly like you.
And there are more people that like you in this world, just with everyone. There are more people that like you who don't like you.
Right. Yeah. And that's what I'm like always trying to tell people. Like, don't worry about the people that don't like you. Right. Like, because there's always more people that actually do. So, you know, that's kind of been my experience where fortunately, a lot of times people are like, I like you.
Right.
Like, and then the people that's like, I don't like you, I usually find out later once I like get into it with
the reason why. There's nothing to do with you, really.
Right.
It's probably misconceptions, miscommunication. Right. Okay. So now you're working with Frank. You're at Baruch. You're going to school.
Yep.
For free.
For free.
Right. How did you go to school for free?
Because I worked there full time. Yeah. So I spent a lot of time at Baruch.
Right.
And once you are, you know, and this is the way most, you know, colleges work. If you work there full time, you get like free tuition.
Right. That's a gem for everyone out there. If you work for a college,
you get free tuition.
You may be able to go there for free.
And so I worked there full time. And then in the evening, I would go to school. Mm-hmm. But then I was also like active on the campus.
Right.
You know, so I was like a part of NABA. So I spent a lot of time at Baruch. But it was really, you know, we kind of talked about that first chapter of my life, like when I knew that I kind of like wanted more and where I saw myself in the future. Frank was really someone who nurtured all of the ideas that I had.
Okay.
All of the, you know, in terms of like progression, like for myself. So he was the one who, you know, when I got the idea to do a study abroad, he was the one that, you know, said, yeah, go and do it. And like,
he was a fan.
Yeah.
He was a fan of yours.
For sure. He was like, yeah, go and do it. When I got the opportunity to go and do an internship in China, he was like, yeah,
we'll hold your position. We'll
go
figure
and do
it out.
Yeah. Go and do it. And kind of like everything all the way up until the end where, you know, I was like looking for a job in finance. He was like, yeah,
go and do it.
So this is this white Italian man who just really, and like to this day, anytime I like go back to Baruch and I have enough time, I go and visit him.
Right.
You know, because this is someone who was always in my corner,
right,
and who always said, yes, go and do these things and go and be great. So for that, I'm like forever grateful to him because he didn't have to.
Right. There's a lesson in that. You know, oftentimes we encounter someone out there,
right,
who's a fan of ours.
Right.
But we miss the mark because we don't recognize that they're a fan of
ours. Yes. Yeah.
And we acknowledge it and then use, I guess, the fanfare to our advantage. So
right,
with working with Frank and knowing how supportive of you he was, you were able to not only just keep your full-time job, but also do everything and experience everything academically,
right,
that you needed,
right,
to. So you never missed out on the experience of being a full-time student,
right,
as well as a full-time employee.
Exactly. Yeah. So I had the benefit of getting a full-time check for benefits, right?
Important as a student.
Exactly. Right. As well as the benefit of, you know, working at the place that you go to school. I didn't have to travel anywhere,
right,
all that stuff. Everything was right there. Mm-hmm. As well as the benefit of getting a first class education and being able to participate in things outside of those two spaces, right?
Right.
The internship in China, as well as like the study abroad in Spain. So to him, I'm like forever like grateful because those things were really integral and kind of like where I am today.
Where you are today.
Yeah.
So when I speak with people who talk about like a good manager, a good boss that they had,
yep,
there's typically some admiration that they have for the person.
Right.
Right. And typically when we admire things, we absorb those things or we try to at
right
least. So what are two things you would say that you got from that job? Because that was like your first major professional job.
It was, yeah.
And that you took with you throughout the rest of your life.
Yes, it was. Oh, that's a good question.
Two things. If you can't do two, one.
Okay. So one thing that I really loved about Frank as a manager was that he was very down to earth.
Okay.
Right. He is, right, because he's still alive. He's a twin. He has a twin brother.
Okay.
He's a, outside of work, he's a DJ. He's very into like 1950s, like doo-wop
and music.
Like he danced too. Like at like the, you know, the
Christmas parties
and stuff. He would actually be out there like this tall, skinny white man breakdancing and like actually doing a good job at it.
Okay.
So one of the things that I really admired about him is he was very professional, but he also was very personable.
Okay.
He had that people element. People loved him.
Okay.
You know, like because he was very down to earth and he just kind of like got in there with the people. And that is something that I took with me. Like the most successful managers are the ones that can relate to the people that they work with. Yes, people understand that you are the boss, mm-hmm, but they also understand that you are a person as well.
Right.
And I think that that helps people to work with people better when they feel like they know you're above them, but they don't feel as if you're better than them.
We're on the same team. Yeah. You're not managing me. We're working together.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And I think that that is one of the things that was important for me. And like, even what I'm doing now is with the whole my people is like, we are
a community,
right? Like we hit, you know, 25,000 followers.
30,000 last I checked.
Yeah. We hit 30,000 followers. Like we did it as a team.
Yeah,
it wasn't just me. Yeah. So that's one of the things that I took with me from my time working with him.
Now you're working full time, right?
Yep.
You're in school full time.
Yep.
You're getting a full time check.
Full time check.
The shopping bags look different when you get a full-time check.
The shopping bags definitely look different when you get a full-time check.
So So where were you shopping? You know, because you were wearing suits every day now.
I was.
You're not a little boy no more.
I was.
You're a man. You feel like one, and you are one.
Yeah. No, you're right. Definitely the checks were different, but I'll be honest, they weren't a lot, right? Like I didn't see real money until I got to banking.
Right.
Right. Like, but you know, the money that I had was enough to, and it was enough to buy the things, you know, that I wanted at that time, you know, like, or that I needed at that time to dress myself in that like professional way. But at that time, I really didn't have a lot of suits. I just knew how to mix and match stuff.
You learned that from your mother. That's what happens when you start school. You get 5 shirts and 2 pairs of pants.
Right.
And all of a sudden you have 10 outfits.
Yeah, exactly. So I knew one of the things that I learned very early on was how to look how I wanted to look, but with the money that I had.
And we talked about this last week, actually, when we talked about, you know, what you do today as far as the custom suiting.
Right.
And, you know, the custom wealthy man top coats and all of that. And we talked about, well, there's levels to it.
Right.
Right. So when you get your first job, you don't buy, you know, a $10,000 suit.
Right.
So talk about what that looked like, because that was like level one. Right. It was like, OK, I'm making $900 every 2 weeks.
Right.
You know, I'm going to go and buy me a new tie, a pair of shoes.
Right.
What did that shopping experience look like for you? Because that was the start of the wealthy guy.
It was. Actually, the wealthy guy, I'm glad that you said that, because the wealthy guy actually kind of started a little before that.
Okay.
Right. So in between, you know, me starting at Baruch and going there full time, I had a string of other small jobs.
Okay.
But, it actually, as a young person, I was making a decent salary at that time, right?
Okay.
So I worked for a company that made like pigment colors for cars, for makeup, for all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
So being like 18, 19 years old, working at this place, you know, I had a pretty good salary. And then after that, I worked part-time at Nordstrom.
Okay.
In customer service.
Nordstrom,
yes. And at that time, that part-time customer service job actually paid $15 an hour.
Right. So that was a lot of money.
So as someone that was...
That's minimum wage in New York now.
Right. And as someone that was, you know, 19 years old... Like 20 years old with 2 jobs, I was making close to $60,000, right?
Wow.
Like as someone at that age. And so my taste in clothes
increased. Right. But you were working at Nordstrom, so.
Right.
So it wasn't like, you know, no, you know. Not like Dr. J's, no shade to Dr. J's.
Right, or Jimmy Jazz.
Or Jimmy Jazz,
like that. Yeah.
That's a different brand, but you were at Nordstrom.
I was at Nordstrom.
You saw men and women with quality suits walking through the door.
Right.
And then you were standing next to them all day.
Right, right. Yeah. So I saw what more high-end clothing looked like and how it should look. So going into Baruch, I had already started to kind of amass a wardrobe of, mm-hmm. of nice clothes. And I've always been good at getting expensive clothes for a cheap price. Right. So I still look expensive, even though I didn't pay like the full price for
that
it.
That was, what was the name of the store? Daffy's?
It was Daffy's.
That was like, look like a millionaire?
Look like a million bucks, something like that was their motto. So, you know, going into Baruch, I already kind of had my dress code, like, you know, already of
so
like
what,
my.
What were your signature pieces? Like, okay, we have a gala. Boom. Body bags everywhere. Yeah, what was your
dead boom? So of course, you know, when you're young, it's all about designer.
Right.
Right. Like,
who was your favorite designer?
Oh, man, I had everything. I
Ferragamo.
Had Versace. I had Ferragamo. I had Dolce & Gabbana. I had Fendi. I had.
Everybody.
And every time I think back to that time, I always cringe
mm-hmm.
because I'm like, oh, like I spend so much money on stuff that really didn't even
although it was matter, at a bargain.
Yeah, right, but even pricey. Still, like, some of the stuff I have no, you know, like, I don't even know what happened to it. But, you know, I was already set kind of going into... to Baruch, but then, you know, once I finally got to banking, that's when I really
got some money,
because it was like at Baruch, people didn't really dress up like that, only more so like the senior, mm-hmm. you know, faculty and administration, but dressing up kind of was my thing, you know, so, but it wasn't until I got to banking where I saw dressing up.
So we're going to get, so I want to fast forward. So you were at Baruch, you were working in student services, right?
Right. And campus operations.
Campus operations. And then you were studying finance initially.
Yeah, I wanted to study accounting.
You wanted to study accounting. Yeah. So you wanted to study accounting. You joined NABA, which was the National Association of Black Accountants, right?
Right.
So you became a member at first. And then while you were a member, I remember having a conversation with you and you was like, I don't want to study finance anymore.
Right.
I like English. Oh, no,
right. History.
I like history. So I want to study history. And I was like, you want to study history, but you're like in the National Association of Black Accountants Club.
Right.
And you want to run for president.
Right.
But then you want to work in finance. Right. So how is that going to work?
Right.
So tell us about that.
Yeah, man. So like, I'm just like the type of person that believes that there's more than one way to skin a cat. Like there's more than one way to like achieve the things that you want to achieve. It doesn't have to be a straight and narrow, you know, it doesn't have to be one way to get to where you want to go. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one, what I knew about studying accounting was that I wasn't going to be good in it, you know? And I was just like, ooh, nah, I can't study something to get a particular job because I probably won't get that job because my grades won't be good.
So why did you think your grades wouldn't be good?
Because I knew from just the classes that I was taking already that it was...
it just wasn't working out.
It wasn't working out because it wasn't natural to me.
It's weird. When I took accounting, because we both were in finance.
Right.
But when I took accounting, it was like I had already worked in finance for a couple of years.
Right.
And I was like, hold up. This is an asset. It's not...
Right.
Debt, and it just was completely different. Right. So I didn't do well in accounting either.
Right. No, yeah, no, I did bad.
Only accountants do well in accounting.
Only accountants do well in accounting. But what I realized is, you know, I always, you know, grade school, middle school, high school, I loved history.
Mm-hmm.
I love watching old movies. I love biopics. I love the past.
Right.
And
History Channel.
Right. And, you know, I was like, I want to study something that I love and that I know that I will do good in because it's something that I'm passionate about. So that's why I chose the path of history, because I was like, I want to be here and I want to study something that I love. But on the other hand, I do want to work in like finance. Mm-hmm. I see myself in that environment. And it was only really through research and talking to people that I realized that these firms accept people with liberal arts degree, right. You know, like with liberal arts majors, like it doesn't have to be finance or accounting. And that's not something that is widely known.
The message is,
right.
You know, study finance, then you can get into Ernst & Young or Goldman or JP Morgan or something like that.
Yeah. But, you know, the reality is that, you know, there's more jobs than an auditor. Mm-hmm. And people who strictly do accounting-based jobs in finance or finance-based jobs in financial services firms, these firms need people with all types of skills.
Right.
Right, to work there. And that's one of the things is just like, okay, well, why do you want to work here? How do you feel that what you've, you know, the skills that you've acquired, you know, pursuing a history degree, how are they applicable to here?
Right.
You know, so that was something that I always had to explain.
So, and going there, so I, again, we know from finance, it's a super day.
Right.
You know, super day. So anybody who's ever went to like a big financial firm out of college, they've probably participated in a super day.
Right.
And explain to the people what a super day was.
So a super day is where they bring together all of, you know, the candidates that made it to the final round. And it's like a round robin where you meet with multiple, you know, senior people in the firm. Some of them have case studies. Some of them have group projects, right, where they put you all together and see how you interact, like, as a group. And, you know, I did the super day for a number of the banks
Goldman Sachs,
at the time. Yeah.
J.P. Morgan.
Goldman Sachs, J.P.
Citi.
Morgan. Yeah. So I did the super day for a good number of them.
How many? So with the history degree, and it really was a competition. I mean,
it is a competition.
Let's just kind of be honest.
Because they only have a few spots.
They only have a few spots. So they may have 50 people they're going to hire, but it might be 500, 1,000 people
right.
interviewing for those spots. So
right.
how many offers did you get with a history degree going against the grain?
Yes. So I got two. But the two offers were like,
creme
boom,
de la creme.
Boom, 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 dead. Right. Like, so the two offers, you know, one was from J.P. Morgan and the other was from Goldman Sachs. And it was just so funny because, you know, people told me like, oh, you'll never get into Goldman Sachs. Right.
They only accept the best of the best.
Right.
And you got to look like this.
Yeah.
And you got to talk like this. And you got to look like
this
on paper.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Oh, they only accept Ivy League, or they only, you know, like they only accept these types of people, or, you know, you have a history degree. Why would they pick you? But they did.
They did.
They did. And so did J.P. Morgan. And the cool thing about J.P. Morgan was that I was like one of the first people out of like 40 to get the call.
You were first round.
Yeah.
First round.
I was like one of the first people to get the call with an offer extended after the super day.
Mm-hmm.
And I later found out that I had the lowest GPA. I had the lowest GPA out of all 40 people.
Let's clarify though. So, you know, we talk about that percentages and things a lot. So the lowest GPA, but what was your GPA though?
Oh, it was like a 3.2.
It was a 3. So that's kind of low. Ass. I thought it was going to be like 3.5, 3.6.
No, it was
so
a 3.2.
So like a solid B,
right,
you know, student.
Right.
Okay,
right.
Cool.
Yes.
That worked. So going into financial services, the one thing that I know is that it's a very conservative environment.
Right.
You learned a lot.
I did.
You grew up. They raised you in finance. And for little black boys turning into black men, finance was not a conversation that we were having at
right,
home.
Right. Oh, for sure not.
And so what did you learn through your journey in finance?
I remember when I told my mom that I got a job offer, you know, at J.P. Morgan. And she was like, why would you go to school all that time to be a teller? You know?
Everybody thinks that when you work at the bank,
right,
you're a teller.
You're a teller, that you work in the branch.
Uh-huh.
And
nothing against tellers. I was a teller for
right.
quite some years.
Yeah. So, you know, I had to, when I look back on it, I really appreciate it because I got to do a lot of different jobs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I started off on a team doing, you know, it was like a project management team, but I started off doing like analytics, like metrics for the team. And it was hard. Financial services. And then I moved into a sales role, like a sales analyst role. And then after that, I moved to Hong Kong and I did like sales strategy and business management. Then when I came back, I did like a CFO role for Latin American like sales. You know, for the product family that I worked in. And then from there, a sales business management role. And then I left that, you know, the first bank that I worked at mm-hmm. because I like wanted more money.
Right.
And then I went to the second bank and I did the first role that I did was a business management one for operations. And then I got a job on a new initiative that they, you know, that they were rolling out. And again, right, like they brought this person on and, you know, I started I was actually the business manager for this person. And I remember, you know, we were in a meeting and he was like kind of going through what the proposal was for the initiative. And I started asking questions and he was like, I was like, who's going to do all of this? Right. Like, this is a lot of stuff. Who's going to do all of it? And he was like, do you want to do it? I thought he was being facetious, you know, but afterwards he actually like pulled me to the side and was like, I think you would be great to do this, like to be on the team to do this. And he was like, I was like, but I just got here.
Right.
Literally at that point, it had been 3 months since I had joined the firm.
Unheard of.
And he was like, don't worry about that part of it. Right.
I'll
like,
take care of
if
it.
You want to do this job, you know, I'll bring you on. So I said, let me think about it. And I thought about it. And I was like, this is an awesome opportunity. Let me take it. And I told him that I would accept. And then, yeah, I, you know, kind of got a transfer to that new team and worked that on that new team for the next couple of years. And then, you know, that job was a big travel job.
Right.
I traveled to Baltimore. I traveled to Ohio. I traveled to Brazil. And kind of like after those few years, I was tired. And I was just like, I'm ready to do something different.
So let's jump. Let's circle back a little bit, actually, because it all sounds great, right?
Yep.
So you went to JP Morgan and you met these great people and you went to work in Hong Kong and then you came back and then you had these different roles and then you went over to Morgan Stanley for more money and then you got some great opportunities, but you did it for a specific reason, right? People told you that if you did this,
right,
that would come.
Yes.
Right? Show, you know, put in the work and then you'll make the money.
Right.
But did that happen?
No, it didn't.
It didn't happen. So you hopscotched, right?
Right.
You jumped from left to right.
Right.
You did the world, the international experience, right?
Right.
And that was big. Like you gave up your dogs.
I did.
Right. You moved from the Bronx to Hong Kong.
To Hong Kong, yep.
You know, a completely different experience. But you were doing it with a goal in mind. Like, this is what they told me I should do in order to get this.
Right. I will get more money. I will get promoted.
And that was right. I will get more money. I will get promoted. So then you did it. And what happened?
I didn't.
I got a little bit more money.
Didn't,
you didn't really get promoted to where you thought you were.
Right. I didn't get promoted to where I thought that I didn't get promoted.
Right.
But I didn't get promoted to where I thought that it would take me. Literally at that point, it had been 3 months since I had joined the firm.
Unheard of.
And he was like, don't worry about that part of it, right?
I'll
like
take care of
if
it.
You want to do this job, you know, I'll bring you on. So I said, let me think about it. And I thought about it and I was like, this is an awesome opportunity. Let me take it. And I told him that I would accept. And then, yeah, I, you know, kind of got a transfer to that new team and worked that on that new team for the next couple of years. And then, you know, that job was a big travel job.
Right.
I traveled to Baltimore. I traveled to Ohio. I traveled to Brazil. And kind of like after those few years, I was tired. And I was just like, I'm ready to do something different.
So let's jump. Let's circle back a little bit, actually, because it all sounds great, right?
Yep.
So you went to JP Morgan and you met these great people and you went to work in Hong Kong and then you came back and then you had these different roles and then you went over to Morgan Stanley for more money. And then you got some great opportunities, but you did it for a specific reason, right? People told you that if you did this, that would come.
Yes.
Right? Show, you know, put in the work and then you'll make the money.
Right.
But did that happen?
No, it didn't.
It didn't happen. So you hopscotched, right?
Right.
You jumped from left to right.
Right.
You did the world, the international experience, right?
Right.
And that was big. Like you gave up your dogs.
I did.
Right. You moved from the Bronx to Hong Kong.
Yep.
You know, a completely different experience, but you were doing it with a goal in mind. Like, this is what they told me I should do in order to get this.
Right. I will get more money. I will get promoted. And that was
right. I will get more money. I will get promoted. So then you did it. And what happened?
I didn't.
I got a little bit more money.
Didn't,
you didn't really get promoted to where you thought you were.
Right. I didn't get promoted to where I thought that I didn't get promoted.
Right.
But I didn't get promoted to where I thought that it would take me.
Right. So then you came back and then you jump ship from one firm to another, which is very, very
common.
Yeah. But you actually stayed at both places for some years.
Yeah.
So most people jump after a year or two.
Right.
But you stayed at both places for a few years. And then They told you, you can do this, show me this, and right. then you'll get that. And what happened?
I didn't get it.
You didn't get
right.
it.
Right.
And that's the thing about it. It's not a failure that you didn't get it.
Right.
You know? Mm-hmm. And a lot of people may think that, but all that you did get
right.
from doing those particular things right. helped shape you to be the well, boss, the entrepreneur, yeah. the wealthy guy that you are today.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like when I first kind of left, when I would tell a story, make it seem like it was like a bad place. Mm-hmm. Right. But once I really started to think about it, I was like, if I never had all of these experiences, I wouldn't be able to be doing what I'm doing now.
Right. Because you took all those skills with you.
Right.
I want to talk about ego. So I know.
Yep.
That between Morgan and JP Morgan, well, JP Morgan and Morgan Stanley,
right.
that you were interviewing elsewhere. Tell me about the opportunity you had with Citibank.
Yes. I feel like I deserve, right, to make more money. I'm like, okay, I need to, potentially get like another offer from another place, right? Present it to them. For them to like match it or whatever, mm-hmm. right? So I had started interviewing and I was getting interviews. I was getting a lot of interviews.
Easy.
Yeah, easy at that time.
A lot of experience.
And, I went through a couple of rounds with Citi and it seemed as if the job was mine, and the job ended up not being mine.
So you were just waiting for them to send you an offer.
Right.
So you're waiting for them to send you an offer, but you have resigned.
Right. Because I was like, I got a new job. I thought it was in the bag.
So you resigned from JP Morgan.
Right.
Thinking that you were going to get your offer from Citi any day.
Right.
And then Citi just never called.
No, they called, but they were like,
you didn't get the
giving
job.
You the job. Yeah.
So you were still employed technically with JP Morgan.
Right.
So did you go back and say, oh, hey, yeah, I didn't get the job they didn't even know about the job, but hey, I didn't get it. So
no, they knew about the job. Right. And they wanted me to stay, but
no more money.
Yes and no.
They promised you more money.
Right. Yeah. But I knew that at that point I had to go. Like I couldn't step back and be like, okay, I'm going to accept what you're saying and I'm just going to stay. Like, I knew at that point that I had to go. And when the job fell through, mm-hmm. it was like I didn't have a job.
And that's an important thing. And people don't understand that you're only worth what you accept.
Yes.
You're only worth what you accept. A lot of people feel like, okay, if another company offers me money, more money, then my company's going to say, okay, well, we'll match you.
Right.
Or we'll get you to stay.
Right.
But a lot of times that doesn't happen.
Right.
I know when I worked for PNC Bank, my manager described it as they don't do counter offers or salary matches because they don't negotiate with terrorists. And I was like, what's terroristic about me wanting to make more money?
Right.
More money that I feel like I deserve. Whether you deserve it or not, doesn't matter. But if you feel like you deserve it, then that's what you deserve.
Right.
So you made the transition from corporate America.
Yep.
And you first started in photography.
Yeah. So once I decided to leave my last, job, it was like, okay, I started doing the coats. I had a few sales and it was just like, okay, I want to see where I could take this. And the photography came about because I got the camera to take pictures of like the coats. And it was just like, okay, I invested $2,500 into this camera. How am I going to use it to make money and I turn it into money? And it was just like, okay, well, I can do photography, right? Like naively at the time, I'm just like, oh, okay, I was able to photograph this stuff. This isn't,
this isn't too hard.
Right. This isn't too hard. Let me do that. But, this. I invested a lot of money.
How much? We need to know how much money.
Man.
Because, see, people wake up and they say, oh, I want to be a hairstylist. Oh, I want to be a photographer. I took nice pictures of my grandmother's garden.
Right.
Now I'm a photographer. But how much money did you invest, not spend?
I
invested in the photography business, the lenses, the cameras, the backdrops.
I invested about $15,000.
Yeah. So granted, not at one time,
right?
But you mentioned the cameras were $2,500.
Right.
They weren't the cameras that behind the counter at Walmart.
No.
They were real cameras from a camera shop.
Yes, they were full frame cameras. I have a Nikon, and then I also have a Sony. Mm-hmm. Anybody that knows Sony's, they know that they're not cheap, you
right.
know, like, yeah, like the average one is like 2000 something, you know, like, and that doesn't even include like the lenses.
See, my timeline was a little bit off. So you started doing photography after you were taking pictures of the coats. So the coats had already been a thing.
Yeah. Like, but for a short amount of time though.
Okay.
Right. Like it only had been a few months that I had started doing the coats. Like it was like towards the end of the winter.
So what made you do the coats? Like what happened to where you did the coats? Like, it was just like, I want a fur coat.
Yeah. So with the coats, it was just like, I had been looking for a coat like it for myself for probably 2 years prior mm-hmm. to actually stepping out to decide to like do it, you know? So it was either something from a really high end store that was like $5,000, or it was something from like, you know, like a Zara for like $250 with like faux fur. And I'm like, nah, neither one of these are it. And one day I was walking down Fifth Avenue. I forgot what I was doing on Fifth Avenue that day. I was walking down Fifth Avenue and I saw like someone standing outside like with flyers like advertising like a fur liquidation sale. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's common in New York, right. You know, like these fur liquidation sales. And I was like, you know what? Let me go in here and see if they have the coat that I'm looking for. So I'll go in there to see if they have the coat that I'm looking for. And of course they don't. But the salesperson was like, why don't you just, you know, try to make it like do what you saying yourself. And I'm like, what do you mean do it myself? Like,
why do I want to make a coat?
I just want to buy the coat that I see in my head. Mm-hmm. All right. And he's like, no, you know, you can go to a furrier and have them put a collar on, you know, a coat. So he actually gave me the name of a furrier. And he was like, do you have a top coat already? And I'm like, yeah, I do. I have a few. And he gave me the information. And then I went there. I went to the place that they told me to go to. And I went in and, you know, there was a black man kind of sitting at the front.
Okay.
Right. And he's like, can I help you? And I'm like, yeah, I want to get a collar made. So he kind of like motioned me to like moving close to him.
Uh-huh.
And so I like moved in close. He's like, yeah, man, you go around the corner. You know, like it's going to be too expensive here.
he profiled you.
Right.
He said you couldn't afford what they had in
listen,
there.
Listen, or he was just looking out, you know, okay. Like he was like, go around the corner. There is a Chinese place that will do what you asking for much less.
Okay.
And I did that. And right. I went around the corner and I went to the Chinese place and they did it for me. And I got the first coat and I was like, oh, wow, this is, you know, this is cool. Then I took another coat and did the same thing and started wearing the coats. And people started stopping me on the street and like asking about the coat, like mm-hmm. where I got it from. And then, you know, I told them like I just kind of put it together myself. But mm-hmm. then people started saying that they wanted one too.
Right.
So then it kind of turned into, you know, a business.
So when did you recognize that you were your client?
That's a really good question.
Because you wanted something that wasn't readily available right. for the price point that you wanted to pay.
Right.
So you went out and, you know, did your Dora the Explorer stuff.
Right.
Figured it out, made it, started wearing it. But, you know, you weren't looking to create a business.
I wasn't.
You just wanted what you wanted. I wanted
for myself, yeah.
So when did you realize that you were your client?
When people started, like, stopping me and, like, saying that they admired it, and two, how can they get one?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I'm not the only one who's been looking for this coat.
Right. We think we are, though.
Right.
We think we have all these original ideas.
Yeah. I'm like, I'm
you
not
just the, don't pull the trigger.
Right. Exactly. I'm like, I'm not the only one that wants a coat like this. I'm not the only one that wants to feel this way.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel in the coat?
Oh, man. I felt like the boss. I felt like.
So you graduated from the suit.
Right.
Feeling respected to being the boss.
Right. And I felt like rich and I felt important because in my head, before I even got the coat made, it was like, I want a coat that fits nicely over a suit that is a good quality wool or cashmere coat with a luxurious looking fur that blows in the wind. And I'm just walking down the street in my coat and the wind is blowing and heads are turning and people are looking. And I just knew the feeling that I wanted to have with the coat on. And when I actually got the coat made, that's how I actually felt. And that's how I still feel when I put it on. Yeah, people like, they just look and like, yeah, you doing it. Like,
where's the first place you went when you wore the coat?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I wore to work. I wore to work. I took the train. I took the train and I wore to work. And I actually, that my coat is something that it's noticeable.
Right.
Right. And usually in, financial services, they are much more understated when it comes to coats. And yeah, it's much more conservative. So I was a little like concerned about wearing the coat, but I was like, I'm wearing this coat.
Right.
I'm wearing this coat and I'm walking in the office with this coat on.
I'm
yeah.
the boss.
With this coat on. And I did. And it was like, people were looking and they were like, wow, that is, I remember, my boss at the time was like, that is some coat, like that is something, what that really means.
And that is some coat means that's too flashy.
Right. It's too flashy.
I wouldn't wear it. How much money do you make to have a coat like that?
Right.
It's all of these questions
right.
that come from, ooh, that's something right there.
Right. Right.
Who does he think he is?
Right. Because sometimes we think that people are complimenting us when they're really not.
And it doesn't matter.
Because
when you feel good in that coat.
Exactly. And I felt good and it didn't matter, and then I continued to wear the coat.
And it was affordable.
Until I quit. And it was
But it was affordable.
Yes.
It wasn't cheap.
It's not cheap.
But it's affordable.
It is affordable.
And that's what, when I always tell people about your coats, they're like, oh, I spoke to someone recently. Like, I didn't know Rob made those coats. They're like, how much are those coats? And I'm like, I don't know, I think between $1,000 and $2,000. They're like, oh, they're kind of expensive. I said, but they're affordable. And they were like, but they're like $2,000. I'm like, but it's affordable.
Right.
It's not for everybody.
Right.
But it's for the person that wants to feel the feeling that you have.
Right.
And it's the person that wants to look the way that you look in the coat.
Exactly.
Now, so you got your own coats.
Yep.
You were in the office.
Yep.
You chucked the deuces on them.
I chucked the deuces.
You started photography.
I started photography and selling more coats.
Yep. What were the pain points for selling the coats? Because you described your top coat going down the street,
right.
getting the fur put on it. But that's not how a business can develop.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. So the pain points were, one, I quit at a time where the winter was over.
So nobody was checking for coats.
Right. I quit at a time where the winter was over. Two, the process that I started out with initially was either someone gives me an existing coat and I put the fur on it, or I get a top coat, right? I purchase a top coat and get the fur put on it for the person. Right. Now, the challenge with that is that the coats that I was purchasing and using, they could run out of stock,
right?
The price changed. It was out of season. All of these things. So it was like, okay, how do I get around this and create like a sustainable business?
Right.
And it was like the coat had to be fully custom.
Right.
That way you don't have to worry about out of stock. That way you don't have to worry about sizes, right? Because the coat is custom made to the person's body.
Right. So going through that, starting that, when did you realize that, okay, the coat was something that you would do?
Yep.
But photography is what actually took off.
Yeah. Because at the time, like I said, it was the end of March. Spring was here.
And nobody
it was like,
for...
nobody was even thinking. And I was a new business. So mm-hmm. It was just like,
who was this?
So it was just like, okay, what can I do in the meantime while I prepare for the winter, mm-hmm. right? To come back around. What can I do to make money? And it was the photography.
Okay.
And, you know, I took the class, right? I got Groupon. The camera. I got a group $30 Groupon and I took a photography. It was a 3-hour class, you know, teaching you the basics of using your camera. I took that class. I even paid for a second class that I never redeemed. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, I can do this, you know? And I like kind of went away and just started studying and practicing.
But then you started working for them.
And then I ended up teaching the class.
So right. You took the 3 months class.
After, no, about four months or so after I took the class.
For like $12 an hour.
For $11 an hour.
For $11 an hour. So right. It wasn't about the money. It was about getting the skill.
It was about getting the skill.
Learning.
Yeah, it was about getting the skill. I eventually threw up the deuces to them too.
Right. Right. It was to corporate America.
Right. Yeah. So, but, you know, you never would think that someone would, you know, take a class 4 months earlier and end up teaching it 4 months later.
Right.
You know, like, but that has always been my skill. I mm-hmm. love teaching things. So, mm-hmm. you know, just give me a script or give me whatever. Tell me what I need to talk about and I can talk about it.
Right.
And that's what I did with the class. And I loved teaching the class, but I also learned a lot about photography during that time. And then also on my own practice, got my friends together, got whoever, and was like, let me take your picture.
Right.
And, you know, at first I wasn't charging that much, but as, you know, soon I realized that I was doing too much work for a little bit of money. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And then I restructured the business, the photography business, and made it a more high-end service.
Right.
And then, you know, and that changed the amount of money that I was like actually getting for the business.
And it became something sustainable to live off of.
And it became something sustainable to live. It became a real business.
Because
yeah.
when you don't make enough money to pay your bills, it's a hobby.
Right.
You
right.
have to figure out how to actually make it a business and monetize it.
Right.
So in business and being an entrepreneur, you were doing the photography, which can get really busy.
Right.
Then you were doing the custom made men's top coats with fur, without fur.
Right.
Then you started introducing the suits.
Yep.
And then so while all of that was going on, you know, you were at the pinnacle, right?
Right.
Everything was going good.
Yep.
You know, you had photography clients, you had suit clients, you had coat clients. Then a new year came around and although all those things were going on, like tragedy struck.
Yes.
You know, like you lost like two people that were like your brothers. One, which was your brother.
Right.
Your blood brother. And two was a close friend that was like a brother.
Right.
That you had known for what? Almost 20 years.
Over 20 years.
Right.
Yeah.
And so all of that was going on. Where were you mentally?
Oh, man. I was like trying to like push through and like be okay because I knew that the business was my livelihood,
mm-hmm.
but mentally I was trying to process all that happened because everything changed in an instant, family wise, friendship wise, right? Like all of these things, all of these things changed like instantly. Not only that, I had just, you know, got out of like a long-term relationship,
yep.
right? Like 2 months prior to that.
Right.
So all of these things kind of boom at the same time.
Right.
And it was like, my first kind of reaction was, okay, well, the business still has to run. So let me just keep working.
Right.
But
it was dismissing it.
But also people just kept saying,
Give it its appropriate time.
You have to give it its appropriate time and you have to kind of like address your feelings because you're going to be working and it's going to blow up when you don't want it to blow up.
Right.
And I was just like, you know what? Yes. So at that point I said, okay, I'm going to take like a week and a half off to kind of just like deal with my emotions and deal with my feelings. But even now still, right? Like it is all of the things, the relationship, the loss of my brother, the loss of my friend are things that I still deal with every day.
Every day.
While still trying to, you know, run the business.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely been a challenge and people don't see that part.
No, they don't.
You know, people don't see that part. And most people that follow me don't even know right. about those things happening, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I did talk about it briefly when it happened, when I said I was kind of stepping away from social media for a bit, but there's been so many new people to the Wealthy Guys since then that they don't know that that happened, you know, like they don't know these things. And, you know, they just see me and they see me like, you know, talking my talk on Instagram and on the videos, and they have absolutely no idea, like behind the scenes, like the things that I'm like dealing with.
And that's important to know, because a lot of times when entrepreneurs get together and they speak, and I know a lot of entrepreneurs here in Atlanta, we try to be a corporation.
Right.
You know, we're a one-man show. You know, right. We're the HR, CEO, CFO.
Right, the janitor.
We're everything, right? But we try to have feelings like a corporation, as if things can kind of blow past.
Right.
But we're experiencing life.
Right.
You know, bills have to be paid.
Right.
You know, it's not like you're not selling a coat every day. I'm not selling a house every day.
Right.
But bills still have to be paid. You know, we have, you know, personal experiences.
Right.
And people think that, oh, well, everything's going great. This is what's going on. You know, we don't have to address that. But those things are life distractions.
Yes, they are.
And if we don't share those things, I think the next entrepreneur who may be looking at you like, oh, he has it all together.
Right.
It's shortchanging them. You know,
it is. Yeah. You're right. Like, because it is not all roses every day, and you don't make money every day.
Right.
And things aren't all good every day. You don't have people beating down your door to give you money every day. And while all of those things are happening where you're not getting money,
the bills are still doing the same day.
The bills are still coming and life is still happening all around you.
Regardless.
Every day.
I always say to you, and I always say to everybody, I don't care what you have going on. A single mom with 10 kids, a single man with 3 businesses, 10 dogs, 50 cats, everybody gets the same 24 hours in a day.
Right.
So you have to figure out how to use it and how to allocate it.
Right.
The Wealthy Guy.
Yep.
Wealthy. Yep. W-E-L-T-H-E.
Right.
Wealthy. Where did that come from?
So in thinking about what I wanted, you know, kind of like the brand to be called and what the cult, you know, what I wanted the cult to be called, I went through this process of, you know, I'm like, okay, how do I feel with it on? And it's like, I feel rich.
Rich.
Like, and I'm like, but it can't be called the rich guy.
Right.
You know? So then what I started doing was looking up words associated with money, you know, rich, affluent, wealth, you know? So I got to wealthy. But I'm like, it can't be the Wealthy Guy, W-E-A-L-T-H-Y, right? Mm-hmm. So I looked at you know, how it's pronounced, and it was W-E-L-T-H-E with that accent over the E. And I'm like, that's it right there. That's it. It's the Wealthy Guy.
Right.
And it really took time for people to, one, know what they were saying. The Wealthy Guy. Even now, people still are like, you know, say it's the Wealthy Guy. But I'm like, look at the accent over the E. Look at the accent like, over the E. Right. So, but I was like, that is perfect, because when the clients put on the coat, I asked them, even now, I asked them, how do they feel? And they say they feel rich. They feel wealthy.
Right.
Like they feel like somebody.
It came across.
So, yeah.
The brand matched perfectly.
Exactly. So Wealthy is to me, the perfect name for the brand.
And it took off. The coats like took off running.
Yeah.
First year of the coats.
Yep.
Atlanta, like Small Boutique Fashion Week.
Yep.
Chicago.
And New York. Yeah.
So
New York
Fashion Week. Three big fashion markets all in the same year, months apart.
Yep.
For a brand new brand.
Yep.
You know, showing these, you know, wealthy men top coats with the fur.
Right.
And people loved it. You know, it was urban.
Yep.
Like it was classy.
Yep.
It was casual. It was dressed up. It was so universal, because I went to obviously the show here in Atlanta.
Right.
And people just was like, ooh, what's that? Ooh, the white one. Right. Ooh, I want that tiger one, the Lion King one. You know, they didn't know the names of the coats, but it was like, ooh, I like that one right there. And it was just like, I want one of those.
Right. Right.
You know, and it kind of propelled in a sense of you needed to figure out how to make more of them.
Make more of them. Yeah.
And so when you were going through that process of figuring out how to make more of them, people started asking you, oh, well, do you have pants? Or do you have shoes?
Right.
Do you have suits?
All of these things.
And so people not only wanted to be wealthy in the coat.
Right.
They wanted to be wealthy. They wanted to feel wealthy.
Right.
And so that's how the suits came about.
Yeah. Yeah, because I initially didn't think that I would do suits, but people were always like, well, do you make other stuff?
Right.
You know, so then it was like, well, why not? And I'm like, okay, well, what do I know about?
Right.
Right, because the coats was something I didn't know about.
Right.
Like, I had to learn everything about that from scratch, but suiting is something that I know about. So it was kind of a natural progression for me to do suiting because I have a lot of experience with suiting, but the suiting piece of it, because suiting is such a saturated market, right? There's tons of people that do suiting. There's not a lot of people that do the coat. So the coat business, of course, you know, it's been around longer than the suit piece of it, but it's like now the suit piece of it is, I have to build that part.
Right.
To get people to come to me for a suit. You know, because the coat is like almost kind of like sells itself. If you have the money,
you're gonna buy the coat.
But the suit is a harder sell because a suit you could just get so many places.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can go to a store and you can get it altered, and then boom, you have your suit. And then not only that, there's tons of places that do custom suiting.
Right.
Right. So it's like, but someone to come to me, it's because they want me to do it.
To do the suit. And why would they come to you?
They would come to me because, one, I'm the wealthy guy, right? Two, I'm going, making a custom product for someone is more about the experience to me, right? Like, because you're sitting down with this person and you are picking out each piece of their product.
Mm-hmm.
And it is only for them. No one's body is the same in this world, right? So no one, even if someone has a similar body shape to you, it is still not the same.
Right.
The coat will not fit the same. So to get a coat or a suit that's specific for you, to me, that is an experience of you, you know, putting something that you see in your head for yourself, bringing it alive. And for someone to come to me, it's like that experience of creating with me, right? Because there's people who do custom suits that are more knowledgeable than me, right? That have been doing it longer than me. So really it's you wanting to have this life experience with me.
Right.
Yeah.
And so when you think about that, why custom? Not why custom with you.
Right.
But why custom?
So the reason why custom is because of the same point of it is for you. You have on something that no one else in the entire world, more than 7 billion people will have, right? Like it is specific. Made for your body. And not only that, it is something that you had your hand in, right? It's not like you know, we go to the store, someone else comes up with these ideas.
And they say, you buy this, I think you like this.
Right, yes. This is the trend.
This is the trend. This is what you should be wearing.
This is what you should be wearing. And, you know, we sell it in these standard sizes, so which never fit anybody.
You can't get it.
Right. But you can get it. It's just not going to fit you right.
Right.
You know, and the thing with custom is that it fits you right. And people love things that are specifically for them.
So I can go to Macy's now and I can get a Calvin Klein or a Bar 3 suit or whoever. Right. I can go there and I can get those type of suits there. But then when I come to you and I'm like, you know what? I want to get a custom suit. Who is that person that gets the custom suit?
Oh, man. The man that gets a custom suit is someone
Or coat
is someone who sees themselves as a boss, right? Like, who sees themselves as someone who has, you know, either accomplished things in life or who is wanting to accomplish things in life. People who command a certain type of respect from others. Mm-hmm. People who want to be noticed. People who want to feel good. Mm-hmm. About themselves and know that what they've invested in,
right,
is quality. And they know when other people see it, they gonna know that it's quality too. Cause let's be real, most of what we do is for other people.
Right?
Like it's for ourselves, but it's because we want to look a certain way to other people.
Be perceived a certain way.
Right, exactly. The guy that comes to me is a guy that takes himself seriously and takes where he wants to take his life.
See, a lot of people
seriously.
A lot of people will say, $1,500 for a coat or $1,200 for a suit, that's expensive.
Yep.
You know, what do you have for, you know, the regular person? But I think of things that we do, right?
Right.
I think of, I'm not going to tell my butter story.
Right.
But I think of things like when I first started drinking alcohol.
Right.
Right. So when I first started drinking alcohol, you know, Absolut was the vodka of choice.
Right.
You know,
right.
I was like, okay, let's go get a bottle of Absolut.
Right.
You know, but I had never tasted like a premium vodka. No, right. No, you know, nothing against Absolut.
Right.
But when I tasted better, I started buying better.
Right.
And so when I think of something custom, I think of I deserve it.
Right.
I work hard.
Right.
You know, I go on vacations.
Right.
Right. I live a certain lifestyle. So
right.
I deserve, I've earned the right to reward myself with a $1,500 coat.
Right.
Or with a $1,200 suit.
Right.
And it's not before when we look at movies and things, we saw like the Italians that said, oh, this is custom suits. You saw them. They showed you.
Right.
But they were drug dealers. Right. They were drug lords going to the tailor.
Mob and this
mob
and that
getting
other.
Measured.
Yeah.
And it was just kind of like, this is what I wear because I'm a boss.
Right.
You know, and this is how people should see me.
Right.
And they wore suits everywhere.
Right.
Except when they, you know, they're going to kill somebody.
Right.
They wore jogging suits and stuff. But but when they everywhere else, they had on suits.
Right.
And when they walked down the block, the women loved them.
Right.
You know, people respected them.
Right.
And so when I think of custom now, because, you know, I never had anything custom.
Right.
You know, it was like, well, why? You know, this looks good. This fits here. This is kind of. But when you know better and you feel better,
right.
You'll consistently do better. But
right.
I'm not. I deserve it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And once you actually experience it, you'll see the difference.
You'll see the difference.
Yeah. You'll see the difference and you won't want to go back.
Right.
Because now you've tasted, like your story, butter.
The butter. You tasted butter. Right.
Right.
And I think that's what people don't get.
Yeah.
And it's hard to kind of communicate it because when people ask you how much something costs,
right.
They already have in their mind how much they're willing to pay.
Right.
You know,
right.
They already say, oh, well, I'm not going to pay more than $400.
Right.
$1,200? What do you mean $1,200?
Right.
You know,
you can't communicate really the feeling.
Right.
And get someone to, you know, necessarily, they have to actually feel it.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, I love that you're doing the custom thing.
Yep.
You know, I know a lot of people said, oh, well, it wouldn't work or there
right.
wouldn't be enough people to buy things.
Right.
And you and
it's
I was
too expensive.
It's too expensive. You know, you catering to the bougie rich
right.
people and different things like that. But I know from growing up, I know from being around people, I know from experiencing things that people pay for what they want.
They do.
With custom suits, we didn't grow up with that.
Right.
White and black.
Right.
You
yeah.
know, white and black. Even wealthy people, they didn't
right.
necessarily always get wealthy suits. They got nice suits.
Right.
But they didn't necessarily get a wealthy guy type of suit.
Right.
But now it's affordable luxury.
Yeah, it is.
You can get a $125 suit.
Right.
But you are getting a luxury product that fits you well.
Right.
That somebody will look at you and be like, that's so custom.
Right.
And
right.
they're going to say that because
right.
your leg is going to be
right.
perfectly fitted.
Exactly.
Your jacket is going to be perfectly fitted.
Right. Yeah. It's going to look It's for you, you know? So to me, there's nothing like that feeling. It's nothing like that experience, you know, that fit is there. You're not going to get that fit in the store. Mm-hmm. And not only that, you go to the store, you buy something. Can you get it altered? Absolutely. But now you've spent, you know, so let's say $200 on your Calvin Klein suit from wherever. Now you're going to have to invest another $200 to $300 to get it to look.
Because you have to do a lot of alterations.
Yeah.
It's not just a hem.
Right. Yeah. To get it to look like it was made for your body. And then even still, it doesn't.
The thing that I love about the coats, because, you know, I'm not a flashy person.
Right.
The thing that I love about the coats is that it's two coats in one.
It is.
A lot of people don't know that the fur collar is detachable.
Yeah. So the fur collar is detachable. You know, to me, that is one of the best things of the coat, mm-hmm. because it is essentially two coats in one. In the daytime, you can wear your top coat, right? You can wear it to work. You can wear it with jeans and a sweatshirt. You can wear it, you know, with a shirt and a sweater, mm-hmm. right? Like, you don't have to always wear a top coat with a suit. A top coat to me is like such a versatile, like, fall winter coat. Mm-hmm. But then when you're ready to step out and throw on a little flash or go to whatever event, you could just put the fur, you know, on the coat. You could never put the fur on if you want to. You could put the fur on once a year if you wanted to, you know? So you essentially have those two coats in one for the everyday as well as one for the step out. And if you want to wear the fur for every day, you can too.
Right.
Yeah. So that is like the beauty of it. And, you know, what I see a lot of guys do is get a fur, you know, piece from a thrift store or something like that and just kind of drape it over, you know, their coat. And it's like, it doesn't look good. But with my coat, every fur collar is made specifically for that coat.
For that coat.
So that it looks like it belongs together, because it does.
And the great thing about that guy that goes to the thrift store to get that fur piece to put it over the coat, you know they want one of your coats.
Right.
They just either think they can't afford it,
right,
or don't want to spend the money.
Right.
But they can do payment plans with
right.
you.
Right.
There's so many different ways to really still achieve that rich look, because at the end of the day, they're trying to get that look because people are like, oh, what's going on over here?
Right.
What he got on? Where you got that from?
Right.
And everybody exactly. wants, you know, what's better than someone saying, oh, well, this is custom. You know, I got this is custom.
Right. Yeah, this is for me.
Kills you all can't the questions. Get this. You can't yeah. get this. You got to go to my guy.
Exactly.
So real quick, I'm going to ask a couple more questions and then kind of, you know, end that there. But
yep.
a couple things that I wanted to know is, you know, one, what is the next thing for the wealthy guy?
The next big thing for the wealthy guy is the woman's coat.
Okay.
So I'm putting it out
wealthy
there
because
I have to do it.
Wealthy lady.
Wealthy gal. Is the woman's coat. You know, the coat was for a man.
Why?
Because it was the coat that I saw myself
in. You knew. Okay.
You know, like, and I said, we don't have, as men, we don't have this.
Right.
But, you know, over the past, you know, 2.5 years, women are always like, what about us? Where's the woman's coat? Where's the woman's right. coat? And my thing has been, I don't want to just make a woman's coat to make money. Right. I have to feel right about it, like how I felt about the man's coat, mm-hmm. right? Because then that's when I'll be able to sell it and really believe in what I'm selling and right. be able to talk to it. I don't just want to just do something just because people are like, they want it. Mm-hmm. Like, it has to feel right to me. So that's why I haven't done it up until this point, but now it's time.
Now it's time.
Yeah, it's time. It's time.
Have you come up with a concept?
I have.
You got a concept.
I have the concept.
So when are we going to see that woman's concept?
This fall.
Fall ends what? December, right. Was it November 23rd? I need something more specific.
Oh, man.
I'm going to hold you accountable. When can we see the first coat?
You're going to see it in this fall.
I'm going to challenge you to have the first woman's coat by October 15th.
I think that's realistic.
That's realistic. That's okay, we don't need in default. We need
preferably before then.
September 30th.
Right.
September 30th. Okay. Then. Okay. You guys heard it. September 30th or latest October 15th. Last question that I have is for all of those community members, because you haven't given everyone a name yet. You just call them my people, my people.
My people,
you
yes.
ask people for suggestions on what you should call them. You got tons of followers.
Right.
A lot of people are asking, you know, they want to be like you. How can I get started like you? What can I do?
Right.
What advice do you give for the next person that wants to have a presence like you, do what you do? You know, because we're a lot of people. Let me take a step back. A lot of people, when you ask them, you know, how can I do what you do? How can I be like you?
Right.
They're afraid that somebody's going to take their spot.
Right.
But there's unlimited seats.
There's unlimited seats.
We can sell the same thing. We can sell the same bottle of Hennessy.
Right.
But I'm going to sell it different from you.
You are.
And your people are going to buy from you and my people are going to buy from me.
Right.
So what do you tell the next person? What are some key points that they need to make sure that they do to invest in themselves and their business in order to be taken seriously?
Oh, that's such a good question. And it could be a really long one, but okay. Few key things. One is do what feels right. Like do what your gut tells you is the right thing to do, but do it 100%.
Right.
Do it 100%. The second piece of advice that I would give is everything doesn't have to be perfect, but it should be close. It should be close.
No half step.
Right. Like it should be close. But, you know, one lesson that I had to learn was everything doesn't have to be perfect. And sometimes it's better to have something out that's close, you know, that's really good than nothing at all.
Right.
Right. So I had to like just stop getting in my head and just say, okay, let me just put something out and see what happens. So those are two things. And the third thing that I would say is you have to live what you are like selling.
Mm.
You know, like you have to be what you are selling, and you have to be like proud of whatever it is that you're doing.
Because you're the first client.
Because you're the first client. You're the first client. And if you want people to get excited about your product, you have to be excited about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to stand by it. And I think that I've done a pretty good job at standing by the product. Mm-hmm. Like I wear it.
It's appropriate.
Yeah.
That's the other thing. It's appropriate.
Yeah.
You know, not to say there's anything against anyone selling anything, but you're a style influencer.
Right.
So you're selling clothes.
Right. Right.
You know, you're not a style influencer.
Selling water.
Selling vacuums.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so it's an appropriate product that you're positioning.
Right.
And you've invested the money. More importantly, the time.
Right.
And you've allowed the cycles to actually run.
Right. Most of them, because you know me. Like right. I try something. Some stuff and it don't pop right away. I'd be ready to throw it away.
Right.
You know, but what I've learned over time is you got to give stuff time.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Because people don't just automatically jump on stuff. It takes time, right? Like the Popeye's chicken sandwich. Popeye's chicken sandwich has been out for months. And now all of a sudden
everybody knows about it.
Everybody knows about the chicken sandwich. Right, and they want the chicken sandwich. So, you know, so things take time. And you taught me that actually, like, well, you just gotta let it cycle a little bit.
You gotta have
like,
a cycle.
No, it's not working. I'm gonna move on to something else.
What's the good thing about the cycle is you determine what the life cycle is.
The cycle is.
So, you know, you don't just try it and throw it away. You say, okay, well, let me see if this works.
Right.
Okay, it doesn't work. I'll give it a month. But you don't complain about it after a week.
Right.
You look at what's going on in a month and it's like, hey, you know what? This actually doesn't work. And you don't want to do the wrong thing for too long.
Right.
You know,
right.
So you have to be conscious of what that cycle is. But so glad we were able to get you on the podcast.
Right.
Hopefully hopefully all your people got a glimpse into knowing you. You know, I'm proud of you. I admire you. This man works hard and he puts a lot of thought And he puts a lot of quality in everything that he does, from, you know, whether it be a contract, whether it be, you know, linen fabric, right, how things are supposed to look, how seriously he takes his business. And I mean, he's a man to do business with. So I'm glad that we were able to get you on for you to tell your people a little bit about you.
Right.
And hopefully you guys learned a lot and enjoyed it, and you'll be the next person to hit that 300 coat mark.
Exactly.
For the next six months, because the countdown is on.
Listen, I'm gonna hit it. I don't know how yet, but I'm gonna hit it. But, you know, thank you for, you know, suggesting this. This was not, you know, a lot of times, you know, what people have to learn about, you know, running businesses and things like that is that you have to be open to ideas from other people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Javon came to me, he was like, you need to be the guest on the podcast. Right. Like, people need to, like, get to know you. And at first I was like, oh, I didn't even think about me being being on the podcast and kind of sharing my story in this way with people. But it actually, you know, ended up being a really good idea. So, you know, that's the other piece of advice. Be open to feedback and mm-hmm. ideas from other people, because other people see things that you don't necessarily see because you're in it.
Right.
Right. So my people, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the My People podcast. Thank you to Javon for, you know, interviewing me. Show us some love and subscribe to our show. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do so on Instagram at the_mypeople_podcast or by email at themypeoplepodcast@gmail.com. Again, if you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe and leave us a review on your listening platform. This is the end of season one of the My People podcast. Ooh. There'll be plenty new things. Yeah. In season two for the My People podcast. So can't wait to, you know, get that started. It's the Wealthy Guy, and I'll see you soon.